Well, today marks the end of 2 weeks of counting. There are five more ahead of us. Now, as soon as I say that, I'm assuming that you know immediately what I'm talking about. Mr. Kilom actually made a brief reference to it in the In Accord from this week that we just saw. He made a reference to the fact that the first festival season, the spring festival season, is just over, of Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread. But as he said, that doesn't mean we forget about them and forget about what we learned, even as we're looking forward to the next season, which is, of course, Pentecost season, with just the one annual festival in it, as we learned many years ago for many of us, and that's 5 weeks ahead, 5 weeks tomorrow to be exact. Today is day 14 in the count. So we are finishing up 2 weeks today, and of course, as the instructions are in the book of Leviticus, 7 weeks shall be complete till the morrow after the Sabbath. And that's, we have two down and five more to go, and then the morrow after that seventh Sabbath will be Sunday, June the 16th, which happens to also be Father's Day this year. So it sometimes turns out that way. Did you catch what he said about the season just passed, the reference, passing reference? He said, in effect, we shouldn't stop learning the spiritual lessons from it. He said, we don't want to forget about it, even though the physical metaphor of leaven no longer grabs our attention the way it did during that season. You know how it is, if you go to eat out somewhere during the Days of Unleavened Bread, you don't have to just be on guard against the types of foods we won't eat at all because we consider them to be what God said is unclean food, unclean meats. In addition to that, we're also on the lookout for leaven. Had to chuckle a little bit. My wife and I, as you know, just returned a little over a week ago from our first Canadian trip of the year to Western Canada, to Alberta. I spent the Sabbath of the 27th of April and the last day of Unleavened Bread with our folks, brethren in Calgary and Edmonton area. And we did take a couple of days downtime afterwards in the national park to the west, Banff National Park, up in the mountains, where we had some snow every day. It was still at altitude, and which made it very interesting to tour some of the areas. And we sat down to breakfast one morning there, and didn't have to concern ourselves with leaven because the days had just ended. But I was asking our waiter, I said, do you have any breakfast meat that isn't pork? And he said, yeah, we have some ham. And I wanted to say, well, if it comes from a pig, it's pork. But he caught up, so, oh yeah, he said, I guess that's pork too. I said, I guess it is. It turns out they did have some sort of beef sausage, so I was able to order that. But it just shows how people aren't aware. But during the Days of Unleavened Bread, added to that, you have the concern about leaven. And you know, I wasn't able to talk to him while he was still alive, but I never was able to ask Colonel Harlan Sanders of Kentucky, what's in the KFC special preparation? What all those spices, what's in there? And I don't know to this day, because maybe he took the secret to his grave with him. Probably not. But those are things we have to concern ourselves about during those times. Why do we pay attention to that? Because our lives are not limited to the physical, but we can appreciate the fact that God wants us to learn deeper spiritual lessons from rehearsing the physical every year in its time and in its cycle. In fact, if we don't learn the spiritual lessons from the physical tools he gives us, we will have missed the crucial point of all. But God knows human nature. He knows human beings because he created them. And he is aware of their propensity to forget. And if we are given this reminder in a physical sense every year, it helps solidify the lesson in our minds. The question for us today is, now that we're 2 weeks past and into the count, 5 weeks to go till Pentecost, 5 weeks tomorrow, what do we intend to do about that? What do we intend to do? If you'll bear with me a little bit today, I'd like to take something of a circuitous route to get to the heart of the message for this afternoon's sermon. I'd like to go back a little bit, and you're going, oh no, here it goes, and here it comes. I'd like to go back in history. I'd like to go back a little bit in U.S. history, this country, and examine from that perspective how a phrase in our English language came into being. One that you've probably heard, and certainly I hope will remember after today's sermon. Where it came from, and what it means in common usage, and most importantly, how it relates to us right now between the first festival season of the year and the second festival season of the year. That's the vantage point, the critical vantage point we want to know. So to begin, we need to go back about 50 years to the early 1970s. Looking out, I see a few folks out there with hair roughly the same color as mine, so I know there will be some who say, yeah, I remember that. How did it get to be 50 years ago? It's just the way things work. The early 1970s. This nation, as those of you who alive then will recall and of an age to remember, was embroiled in what had become a very unpopular war. In fact, we just had the anniversary a few days ago, in fact, 1 week ago today, of the shootings on the Kent State campus where four students and protesters were shot by the National Guard that had been called out to protect campus property. May 4th, 1970. That's 54 years ago. How is that even possible? My wife was in a high school class 6 miles away that day on May the 4th, 1970. But the war had become very unpopular. It began quietly for the U.S. when in 1956, President Dwight Eisenhower started sending what he called American advisors to the area that had been known previously as French Indochina. France had been the European power to colonize the area, and until 1954, it was known as French Indochina. But in 1954, the communist forces in North Vietnam, known as the Viet Minh, M-I-N-H, led by Ho Chi Minh, drove the French out in 1954. The French abandoned the Asian subcontinent area there, and particularly what became called Vietnam. It quickly divided into two countries, North and South Vietnam, the North being communist-led, the South being, loosely speaking, a democracy affiliated with the West. By the time John F. Kennedy became president, January of 1961, the numbers of those advisors had increased slightly, but they were not combatant soldiers. They were simply advisors to the South Vietnamese military. They continued to grow during his short presidency. He was president for less than 3 years and was assassinated November the 22nd, 1963 in Dallas. In 1964, after Lyndon Johnson had taken over, he had been the vice president and was sworn in as president upon Kennedy's death, an incident occurred that changed the direction of American involvement. North Vietnamese forces fired on U.S. warships that were on patrol in the Gulf of Tonkin. That's an arm of the South China Sea just off the Vietnamese coast. Congress authorized the president to take whatever military steps he considered necessary to defend U.S. forces, even without a declaration of war. And perhaps some could have foreseen that as a nation we were headed right back down the same path as had happened in Korea in the early 50s. No declaration of war. In fact, back then they referred to the Korean conflict as a police action. Of course, some of the American GIs who were fighting and dying said, if it's a police action, why didn't they send in the police? Probably a good question. In 1965, after Lyndon Johnson had been elected in his own right in the election of 64, the first land combat troops from the United States arrived. In the next 3 years, those numbers of combat troops escalated rapidly. By 1968, the war had become so unpopular that President Johnson declared he would not be a candidate for re-election that year. Under the terms of the 34th Amendment governing the accession to the presidency upon the death of the president, because he had served less than 2 years of President Kennedy's term, he could have run for 2 full terms on his own plus that year and a half or so. But at any rate, he decided to step aside and not run for election. Turns out it was perhaps just as well, because he died before he would have completed a second full term. By 1973, weary of the war that seemed never-ending, President Richard Nixon, who had won the election, narrowly defeating Hubert Humphrey in 68, President Nixon engineered a ceasefire which he called peace with honor. But you know, the fighting never really stopped. But even by then, the whispering in the halls of the Pentagon, the military headquarters of U.S. Top brass for the military, had already been happening for a while. They were starting to talk about what was going on and the difficulty the nation was in, and they invented a new phrase to describe the situation. The Nixon administration, they said, had no exit strategy for how to extricate itself from the quagmire that the war had turned into. Following President Nixon's resignation in August of 74, Gerald Ford became president, and early in his time in the presidency, by 1975, the last U.S. troops were airlifted out from the U.S. Embassy in Saigon, South Vietnam. Not long after that, the South Vietnamese government capitulated, and the entire country fell to the communists. The phrase exit strategy was still just, for the most part, a kind of an in-house military term. It wasn't used that widely yet. But by 1993, the public came to understand it in the wake of another U.S. military debacle, this time in Mogadishu, Somalia, Eastern Africa. Following terrible loss of life and dislocation of Somali citizens in a civil war, in late 1992, President George H.W. Bush, the father of President George W. Bush, you saw the FI students visiting the library down there, you saw Mrs. Lynn Marshall sitting in the president's chair at the president's desk that was pictured. President George H.W. Bush sent U.S. servicemen to Kenya, the neighboring country, to try to help more than 500,000 displaced Somali citizens who had fled because of the civil war in their country. By the following spring, there was a new president in the office. Bill Clinton had been elected late in 92, and he was now the president. His administration also came under fire when 18 U.S. troops were killed in backing up a U.N. peacekeeping mission. President Clinton tried to send U.S. troops. The Battle of Mogadishu, as it was called, became known in popular culture as Black Hawk Down. Some of you may recall hearing that phrase. After 2 U.S. Black Hawk helicopters, military gunships, were shot down by Somali partisans. They actually made a movie of the same name that came out back about that time, shortly after. But there were pictures all over the news, all over the world, of naked U.S. servicemen with their tied by their hands being dragged through the streets by some of the partisans of in the civil war in Somalia. President Clinton, his critics said, had no exit strategy. How do you get out of such a mess? On how to get free. He came under criticism for the same thing later in his term with U.S. involvement in the wars in Yugoslavia, as that country was coming apart, torn apart by its various ethnicities following the death of Tito, the president who had basically crafted the nation. UN peacekeeping missions were sent to Bosnia, and Kosovo, Herzegovina, Serbia. It was a mess. With some of those factions fighting, then once again, American troops were bogged down. How do you get them out? By now, the phrase exit strategy had come into more general use. A lot of civilians knew what it meant by now, though it had been a military term. Here's the definition. An exit strategy is a means of escaping one's current situation, typically an unfavorable one. An organization or an individual without an exit strategy may be in a quagmire. At worst, an exit strategy will save face. At best, an exit strategy will peg a withdrawal to the achievement of an objective that's worth more than staying put or than the cost of continuing to stay involved. The term is now used in business. It began as a military term. Occasionally, you even hear it applied to individuals. At worst, in short order, it means cut your losses and run. At best, you hope to get out of a bad situation to be able to pursue a goal that's better than what you would be stuck with if you stayed. But it's still not a good spot to be in. It's not comfortable. Let me ask you a question. Do you know of any quagmires in the stories of God's Word in the Bible? Do you know of any exit strategies in God's Word in the Bible? Well, we just finished a season that was loaded with possible examples. Turn to Exodus chapter 3, and then we'll take a look. Exodus 3. Now Moses, verse 1, was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he led the flock to the back of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord, and if you notice, the angel is capitalized. Whenever you see that, it's a pretty good clue of who we're talking about. And we're going to see that confirmed in just a minute. The angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of a bush. So he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, but the bush was not consumed. Then Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush doesn't burn or why it doesn't burn up. So when the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, here I am. So he said, don't draw near this place. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. Moreover, he said, I am the God of your father, who was the angel of the Lord. Now we know. The one who became Jesus Christ, the Logos, the spokesman. I'm the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look on God. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt. And I've heard their cry because of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. Wouldn't you call that a quagmire? Certainly it was for them. Enslaved for generations beyond the life memories of anyone who could go as far back as you wanted. Generations. So I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians. What do you call that? Isn't that an exit strategy? And to bring them up from that land to a good and large land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, certain areas around there, the Hittites further north and west, the Amorites and the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites. The Jebusites, of course, occupied the area in and around Jerusalem. It was a Jebusite stronghold that David conquered. Excuse me. Now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come to me, and I have seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. Quagmire. Come now, therefore, and I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. So there you have a classic biblical quagmire with an exit strategy proposed by God. Now, God outlined the one who became Jesus Christ, the God of the Old Testament, outlined his general intention to Moses. Of course, it didn't go quite as quickly or as smoothly as Moses seemed to think it would. In fact, if you turn to Exodus chapter 5 and find the first time that Moses and Aaron come before Pharaoh, I'm skipping over parts of the story, of course. Moses didn't really want this duty and he tried to beg off, but God said, you know, Moses said, I don't speak well. And God said, okay, I know your brother Aaron does and I'm sending him to meet you. So you're still going to do this. So now the two of them go before Pharaoh. And they repeat what they'd been told to say. Thus says the Lord God of Israel, verse 1, let my people go that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness. Remember, this is before we believe the institution of any of the annual festivals of God. Passover, as we believe, Exodus 12, was the first time it was ever kept. And Pharaoh said, oh, of course, be my guest. How can I help? Not exactly. He said, who is this Lord that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? I don't know him, and I won't let Israel go. So they said, the God of the Hebrews has met with us. All these nations had their gods. It was a polytheistic world all around them. They were unusual in believing in just one in that sense. Please let us go 3 days' journey into the desert and sacrifice to the Lord our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or sword. What did the king assume, the Pharaoh? He says, why do you take the people from their work? Go back to your work. Go back to your labor. You're just trying to get out of work. You're just trying to be lazy. And Pharaoh said, the people of the land are many now, and you're not letting them work. You're making them rest. So he commanded the taskmasters, don't give them straw anymore to make brick. They got to get the straw themselves. I'm cutting through to the heart of the story. So then the taskmasters went and spoke to the officers of the people. The people were scattered. They made them hurry. The officers of the children of Israel, verse 14, whose Pharaoh's taskmasters had set over them, were beaten because they didn't get their work quotas done. And it all just blew up in their faces. And the people complained. The guards said, you're idle, you're idle. Go and work. Verse 20, so as Moses and Aaron came out from Pharaoh, they met Moses and Aaron, who stood there to meet them, and they said, let the Lord look on you and judge, because you have made us abhorrent in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants. You've put a sword in their hand to kill us. Now what did Moses think? Where was that exit strategy now? In fact, it had not changed, but Moses didn't have all the details. And look at his conclusion. Moses returned to the Lord and said, Lord, why have you brought trouble in this people? Why have you done this, God? Why does God always get blamed for everything? Why is it you've sent me? You told me you were going to spring them free. Since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he's done evil. Neither have you delivered your people at all. Moses was rather bold. Moses didn't have all the details. From a human perspective, the situation got worse. In the next chapter, though, God reassures him. And he says, now you will see what I will do to Pharaoh. Chapter 6 and verse 1. With a strong hand, he will let them go. With a strong hand, he will drive them out of his land. And he spoke to Moses and said, I am Yahweh, the Tetragrammaton, the ever-living one, L-O-R-D, all in caps. I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as God Almighty, but by my name Yahweh, or Y-H-W-H, I was not known to them. I have established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land of their pilgrimage in which they were strangers. I've heard the groaning of the children of Israel, whom the Egyptians keep in bondage, and I have remembered my covenant with Abraham and his descendants. So you tell Israel, I am the Lord. I will bring you out from the burdens of Egypt. I will rescue you from their bondage. That's the exit strategy. I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and judgments. I will take you as my people, and I will be your God. Those are elements of a covenant. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God who brings you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will bring you into the land that I swore to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I will give it to you as a heritage. I am the Eternal One. So Moses spoke thus to the children of Israel, but they didn't heed him because of anguish of spirit and cruel bondage. God tells him to go tell Pharaoh again. And Moses says, do I have to? Now what? And so we begin to see the story unfold. There's a little bit of background given in the rest of that chapter. And in chapter 7, God explains more of his exit strategy to Moses. He said, see, I have made you as God to Pharaoh. You're going to be my spokesman, and you are going to be whatever contact he has with me. And Aaron, your brother, will be your prophet, to use that analogy. You will speak all that I command you. And Aaron, your brother, will tell Pharaoh to send the children of Israel out of his land. And I will harden his heart. And I will multiply my signs and my wonders. And he will not heed you, so that I may lay my hand on Egypt and bring my armies and my people, the children of Israel, out of the land by great judgments. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Eternal when I stretch out my hand on Egypt and bring out the children of Israel from among them. Later on, chapter 10, as we progress further, we see an interesting verse in Exodus 10, verse 7, when Pharaoh's advisors, with the eighth plague looming on the horizon, they say, don't you yet know that Egypt is destroyed? God was working something out here. So the 10 plagues came on Egypt, but still the exit strategy was not complete. Yes, they left their conditions of slavery. They went out with boldness, it says in Exodus 14:8 in the New King James. A high hand in the Authorized Version. But God wasn't done yet, because the very next verse, guess what happened? Pharaoh's army is following them. And the wailing and the screeching and the complaining begin from the people. But God wasn't finished yet. It was going to be a complete and perfect exit strategy. Perspective humanly, we're trapped. Mountains to the left of us, mountains to the right of us. That's not a take on Lord Tennyson's poem of the Charge of the Light Brigade, sorry. Mountains to the left of us, mountains to the right of us, the Red Sea in front, Pharaoh's army behind. It was a quagmire. Until the wind began to pick up that night. And God cleared a path. And when the waters returned over the floor of the Red Sea arm they crossed, that part of the Red Sea they crossed, Pharaoh's army was in it. That's pretty powerful stuff. And all of chapter 15 was a song of praise led by Miriam and leading the women in a dance. The Bible is filled with examples of God working out his exit strategy in the lives of his people. How about another famous one? Turn to 2 Kings chapter 18. This puts us into the reign of Hezekiah, king of Judah. Early in his reign, before the Assyrians turned their attentions to Judah, after they conquered the northern kingdom with its capital in Samaria, that's described in the previous chapter. But in 18 it says, it came to pass in the third year of Hoshea the son of Elah, king of Israel, that Hezekiah the son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign. He was 25 when he became king, and he reigned 29 years. His mother's name was Abi, the daughter of Zechariah. He did what was right in the sight of the Lord according to all that his father David had done. He removed the high places and broke the sacred pillars, cut down the wooden image and broke in pieces even the bronze serpent that Moses had made, for until those days the children of Israel burned incense to that serpent and called it Nehushtan. It was basically a Canaanite goddess. Literally it means bronze thing. He trusted in the Lord God of Israel, so that after him was none like him among all the kings of Judah, nor were any before him. He held fast. He did not depart from following him, but he kept his commandments, which God had commanded Moses. God was with him. The Lord was with him. He prospered wherever he went, and he rebelled against the king of Assyria and didn't serve him. Subdued the Philistines as far as Gaza, from watchtower to fortified city. But now it's going to spin out into the future a bit. In his fourth year, Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up against Samaria and besieged it. 3 years later, they took it. So we're talking about roughly 718 BC, the fall of Samaria in the northern kingdom. In the sixth year of Hezekiah, so now 2 years later, about 716, remember BC, you're dropping the numbers, the king of Assyria carried Israel away captive, put them in Hala by the Habor, the river of Gozan, and the cities of the Medes. It explains why. They've been disobedient. Now we move further. Then the 14th year of King Hezekiah. So now we're moving further down, probably maybe 705, 6, 7 BC. Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and took them. So now the Assyrians have decided that they would like to conquer Judah as well. They figure that's a pretty nice little juicy tidbit of land and people to conquer. Another fine conquest. What did Hezekiah do? You've seen the description of him so far. He's a righteous king. He's still on his throne. The brother nation to the north, Israel, the house of Israel, the 10 tribes there, is gone into captivity. Assyria is still the dominant power. We're still, you know, over a century away from the ultimate fall of Judah to the Babylonians. What's going to happen with a righteous king? Did he immediately understand where to turn? Take a look. In the 14th year, when Sennacherib attacks the fortified cities, Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria at Lachish. That's one of the major cities of Judah in the southwest of the country, southwest of Jerusalem. First place we visited on our tour of Israel 5 years ago. We basically flew all night, landed in the morning, and took off for Lachish, trying to stay awake. It's remarkable. The siege mound is still there. You can see the ramp of earth they built to attack the city. It's astonishing. So Hezekiah knows that the king of Assyria is gobbling up the fortified cities one by one, overpowering their defenders. So he sends a message to him from Jerusalem to Lachish. And he says, I've done wrong. What? How had he done wrong? Whatever you impose on me, I will pay. He tries to appease this tyrant. And the king of Assyria assessed him 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. Where's he going to get it? He gave him all the silver found in the house of the Lord and in the treasuries of the king's house. He stripped the gold from the doors of the temple and from the pillars which Hezekiah had overlaid and gave it to the king of Assyria. Now that's going to work, right? When you have madmen on the loose and crazy people in charge of countries trying to conquer everything in sight, if you just pay them, they'll back off and leave you alone. Isn't that the way it works in history? Yeah, apparently you don't know anything about history if you think that works. They only want more. And that's exactly what happened. The first time Hezekiah did not turn to God for an exit strategy. He sent a message to the king of Assyria, Sennacherib, and said, whatever you tell me to pay, I will pay. Just leave my cities alone. It's going to get worse. Now some of the military officers, the Rabsaris, the Tartan, the Rabshakeh, all military terms and commanders, surround Jerusalem. Lachish has fallen. Surround Jerusalem, and they say, you're next. As you read the story, they insult the guards on the walls who plead with them to speak in Aramaic. We understand that. Don't speak in Hebrew, because then everybody around us gets it and they understand the insults. What did King Hezekiah do this time? Verse chapter 19. So it was, when Hezekiah heard it, he tore his clothes. He covered himself with sackcloth and went into the house of the Lord. Then he sent Eliakim, who was over the household, Shebna the scribe, the elders of the priests, covered with sackcloth, to Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amoz. They said to him, "Thus says Hezekiah, this day is a day of trouble and blasphemy and rebuke." God tells him, Isaiah sends a message. "You tell your master this. Thus says God, don't be afraid of the words which you've heard, which with which the servants of the king of Assyria have blasphemed me. I will send a spirit upon him. He'll hear a rumor and return to his own land, and I will cause him to fall by the sword in his own land." So, sure enough, Rabshakeh returned, found the king of Assyria warring against Libna, for he had heard that he had departed from Lachish. "So he's come out to make war with you." Now he sends a message to Hezekiah saying, don't be deceived by this. Don't think your God is going to deliver you. You've heard everything that's happened to all these nations. Have their gods delivered them from my hand? Hezekiah this time gets the letter. Verse 14, he took it from the hand of the messengers. He read it. He went up to the house of God and he spread it before the Lord. He prayed and said, "O God of Israel, the one who dwells between the cherubim, you are God, you alone of all the kingdoms of the earth. You have made heaven and earth. Incline your ear, O Lord, and hear. Open your eyes and see. Hear the words of the king of Assyria, Sennacherib, which he has sent to reproach the living God." And he goes on to admit, it's true what he says. "They have laid waste the nations and their lands. Nobody's been able to stand up to them. But those gods weren't gods. They were just the constructions of men's hands. Now therefore, O God, Lord our God," verse 19, "I pray, save us from his hand, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you are the eternal God, you alone." Here comes the answer from Isaiah. "Because you have prayed to me, I have heard." And the next few verses tell what's going to happen. Verse 32, it's summed up. "Therefore, thus says the Lord concerning the king of Assyria, he shall not come into this city, nor shoot an arrow there, nor come before it with shield, nor build a siege mound against it. By the way that he came, by the same he'll return. He shall not come into this city, says the Eternal. I will defend this city to save it for my own sake and my servant David's sake." That's God's exit strategy. What happened? The next verse, "On a certain night, the angel of the Lord went out and killed in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000 soldiers." That's a pretty sizable army. In the U.S. Civil War, there was no single army in the field anywhere that was that large at any Civil War battles. The totals may have added up to that, but no single engagement had one army that size in the U.S. Civil War, only about 160 years ago, ballpark. God delivered them. He delivered them. "Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and went away. He returned home, remained at Nineveh. Came to pass," now this actually was something like 18 or 20 years later, the Bible account just skips over the length. "He was worshiping in the temple of Nisroch, his god. His sons Adrammelech and Sharazar struck him down with a sword." That time, Hezekiah went to God for his exit strategy. Brethren, this is where you and I have to turn for our needs for an exit strategy. We've left the days of unleavened bread behind. We're pointing forward toward Pentecost. One reminds us of Christ's sacrifice on our behalf, and the need to live as he lived, an unleavened life. We point ahead to the identifying of who we are, the first fruits, showing the receiving of God's Spirit to give us the help and the strength we need. do we have an exit strategy for our challenges? On the spiritual level, how does it work in the life of individuals now? Or even back then? We're not talking whole nations of 2 or 3 million people now, or smaller nations and armies attacking them. There's a very famous example of one servant of God that we're all familiar with. Maybe we hadn't thought to look at his life in those terms, but he came to be absolutely stuck in a deep quagmire. He thought he knew how to live and what was expected of him. He seemed to have everything going his way. Even Satan, who was allowed to come before God at a certain point, among the angels who came in a sense to confer or consult with God about things, Satan was forced to admit that he was a righteous man. But he still needed to turn to God to have a good exit strategy. The only one that would work to extricate him from the trials that descended on him. His name was Job. In Job 1 and verse 1, we see, I guess you'd say, the public face of the man. What his reputation was. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and shunned evil. And it goes on to list his family, his possessions. He was a wealthy man in this time apparently of the patriarchs. There's no reference to the nation of Israel here, so we believe it actually was before the time of Israel as a nation. Very early book in the Old Testament. And you see this peek into the operations of God's throne room, where he allowed Satan to come before him. And God quizzes him. He says, "Where are you coming from?" And Satan says, "From going to and fro on the earth, walking back and forth," kind of evasive and, you know, kind of snippy. And God says, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there's none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil?" What was Satan's response? "Does he fear you for nothing? You built a hedge around him. You protect him. Nothing bad touches him. You bless everything he does. His possessions have increased. But if you'll stretch out your hand and touch everything he has, I know he'll curse you to your face." You can go through the rest of the first chapter and see systematically when God said, "Okay, I'll allow you to touch anything he has, but not him." His children die in a whirlwind. Marauding bands of enemies attack and carry away his livestock, the source of his wealth. In each case, one servant escapes to tell him the horrible story. And Job's response, he arose, he tore his robe, shaved his head, verse 20, he fell to the ground and worshiped. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I'll return. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away, blessed be the name of the Lord." In all this, he did not sin or charge God with wrong. Horrible turn of events. We know that what follows is instructive for us. His own body became afflicted with agonizingly painful boils, and then his three friends came to comfort him. We even have an idiom in the English language called a Job's comforter, and we know what it means. Somebody who's kind of useless, trying to help out. The best thing they did was to sit the first 7 days with him, and 7 days and seven nights, and not say a word. Job 2:13. That was their most intelligent speech. And the rest of this whole book tells the story of Job. What was going on in his mind? We know he struggled to find his answers in this agonizing trial. He knew it. Logic dictated it couldn't be on God's part, so what was wrong? Take a look at chapter 9. Just hit a very few highlights to get some points in mind. Job 9:21, look at these words. Sense the agony. "I am blameless, yet I don't know myself. I can't figure out what I've done that's wrong. Why would God allow these things?" And eventually his mind even morphs and shifts to saying, "Why would God do this to me? I don't understand. I despise my life." He says it's all one thing. If I say he destroys the blameless and the wicked, what will I do? If it is not he, who else could it be? Verse 24. 27 and 28, if I say I'll forget my complaint, I'll put off my sad face and wear a smile, I'm afraid of all my sufferings. I don't know what they mean. I know you will not hold me innocent. That's a prospect he didn't want to entertain. Have we learned, as Mr. Kylo suggested, the spiritual lessons of the first festival season? So if you want a title for this sermon, I guess we could come to it here. The title would be, What's Your Exit Strategy? We look at the story of Job and we know the end of the story and how it worked out. We know that Job came to see himself, that he was in fact putting himself and his righteousness kind of on a par with God's. He even claimed to be willing to plead his case with God himself. Chapter 10 records that. But he came to see in the end how wrong he was. For Job, it was that aha experience that helped him see what God's exit strategy was. And I think we see it beginning to form in chapter 13. Job 13. I'm going to read four verses. Verses 20, 21, 22, and 23. And I'm going to use a paraphrase, not an actual translation, but a modern paraphrase, the Living Bible. It's been out for many years. But it gives the sense of Job coming to begin to grasp. Oh God, there are two things I beg you not to do to me. Only then will I be able to face you. Don't abandon me. And don't terrify me with your awesome presence. Call to me to come, how quickly I will answer you. Or let me speak to you and you reply. Tell me, what have I done wrong? Help me. Point out my sin to me. Job was coming to a place to ask an amazing thing because of his suffering. He was ready to rely on God for an exit strategy. And God did give it to him. Finally, the young man Elihu spoke up, and God had no words of correction for him. And then God answered directly himself. And Job changed. You can read chapter 42 and see his absolute humility in face of God's guidance and leading him to see what he needed to know. The exit strategy worked. Of course, there's one more example that we really need to look at today. That's our own. Remember how we started this year's observance of God's special times spiritually? Do you remember turning at that point way back when, 3 or 4 weeks ago, to 2 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 5? Where Paul wrote the Corinthian church and said, examine yourselves as to whether you are in the faith. Test yourselves. Do you remember that? That process of self-examination? I'm guessing just about every one of us read this verse, meditated on it, asked God to help us head into the spring festival season of the year on a right manner before Him, in a right manner. And I hope we came to see this as we examined ourselves, and still can see another lesson as we move toward Pentecost, the lesson from Isaiah chapter 55. Isaiah chapter 55. Let's start in verse 6. Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake his way and the unrighteous man his thoughts. Let him return to the Lord and he will have mercy on him, and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, says the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways and my thoughts than your thoughts. Sometimes we think we have an idea of how to proceed. We have a general guideline that we know we must keep obeying God. Compromising with His way and His law and His truth is never the answer. But sometimes there are things we need to know more deeply. And God says, I have the key to that. Sometimes that's the key to our exit strategy from challenges and trials we face. For as the rain comes down and the snow from heaven and don't return there, but water the earth, make it bring forth and bud, it may give seed to the sower, bread to the eater. Everything is all greening up around us. Our grass has been growing faster than it should. Maybe it slowed down just a little bit, I hope. But so shall my word be that goes forth from my mouth. It will not return to me void. It shall accomplish what I please. It shall prosper in the thing for which I sent it. Do we know that about God? Are we considering it in spiritual terms, that His purposes will stand, the thing for which He sends out His word will accomplish, be accomplished? Our deliverance to our ultimate promised land depends on Him and following His guidance, and realizing that if we get ourselves in a bog or a quagmire, and it just keeps getting quaggier and quaggier, we need to turn to Him and find the exit strategy that God helps us understand. Jeremiah 10. Sometimes it involves a very scary and brave thing, and Jeremiah understood that. O Lord, verse 23, Jeremiah 10, I know the way of man is not in himself. It is not in man who walks to direct his own steps. Lord, correct me, but with justice. Not in your anger, lest you bring me to nothing. Pour out your fury on the Gentiles who don't know you, and on the families who do not call on your name. They've eaten up Jacob, devoured and consumed him, made his dwelling place desolate. Jeremiah, it's like he couldn't help himself. Pleading with God, please show me. Please be gentle. Please be. If you're going to get mad at somebody, get mad at the ones that you know, nah, almost. It's kind of a human thing. But he was willing to say, that's what I need to know. I need to know what the exit strategy key is. Jeremiah knew where to go to find it. Wasn't that really the message of the Days of Unleavened Bread, one way or another? That we too need a way out of Egypt? That we too can think we understand how it'll all work out, like Moses in the early stages, and find that life throws us some curves we didn't expect? That we too can find ourselves trapped, like Israel at the Red Sea, and find that we can't rely on our own strength to spring us totally free from spiritual bondage? That we too find that only God can part the sea of our challenges and our trials and sometimes our own sins? In Hebrews chapter 12, there's an interesting phrase. Probably more than one, but let's read this one. Hebrews 12, first two verses. Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, you see the analogy that he's drawing on? Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Looking to Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, the author of the exit strategy. The one who found himself in quagmires too in his physical life, not because of his own sins, he had none, but because of being brought shoulder to shoulder with the sin of the world around him and those who wanted to destroy him, which God allowed, his Father allowed, for purposes of his plan. That was his exit strategy. And Jesus knew it because he so humbled himself to his Father, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and he has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. You haven't yet resisted to bloodshed, striving against sin. Who sets the race before us? Who has the exit strategy out of this quagmire sometimes of human existence? It's pretty clear if you go back to chapter 4 of the book of Hebrews. references in the first few verses a comparison to ancient Israel. Since a promise remains of entering his rest, verse 1, let us fear lest any of you seem to have come short. The gospel was preached to us as well as to them, but they didn't, the gospel, the word they heard didn't profit, not being mixed with faith. And he talks about what happened to them, that the older generation died in the wilderness. That's the reference. He references the Sabbath, and it's important. They'll not enter my rest. There's a comparison made to the future for God's children and his family. It remains, verse 6, that some must enter it. The ones to whom it was first preached didn't enter because of disobedience, the physical comparison of the promised land. But David, it says, after so long a time, today if you'll hear his voice, quoting from the 95th Psalm, don't harden your hearts. Soften our hearts to go to God. If Joshua had given them rest, he wouldn't afterward have spoken of another day. There remains a sabbatismos in Greek, only time that word is used, for the people of God, a keeping of a Sabbath. And he references the future we have in his family. Who has the exit strategy and the strength to get there? These verses are pretty clear. Look at verses 14, 15, and 16. Seeing then that we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession, our profession. We don't have a high priest who can't sympathize with our weaknesses. He was in all points tempted as we are, but without sin. So let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and grace to help and an exit strategy in time of need. That's what we need, isn't it? This strategy, obedience to his instructions, seeking his guidance, waiting for his miraculous intervention one way or another, keeping our eyes on his perfect plan, shown every year in his festivals, that is the exit strategy we need. The days of unleavened bread are now 2 weeks in our rearview mirrors. Flew past in a flash, didn't it, as always. One moment we were finishing putting out the leaven. I don't know about you, but I have this sensation, it's kind of silly in a way, but every year it happens. When the last bit of leaven, the last bag of leaven trash is gone from the premises, I have this wonderful feeling of peace. It's just strange. Now, sometimes it perfectly coordinates with the trash pickup. That's great. Other times, not so much. Those are the times I put on my cloak and my dark glasses and pull my hat brim low over my face and put it in the last little bag and surreptitiously drive down the street looking for a dumpster that nobody spotted. Don't put it on your neighbor's property. That's not a good idea. Does the spiritual analogy transfer for us? Getting rid of sin, a great relief, a sense of peace, an exit strategy. Do we have the same joy and obedience to God in seeking his ways, drawing closer to him, studying his word to develop the mind of his son, the one who so unselfishly gave his life so we can share eternity with both of them? Let's not forget the important spiritual lessons we learn each year in all of this, which is what God wants us to internalize, so it's part of us. Part of the message from the first season is sin's tough to get out. It took an incredible sacrifice to remove the penalty. It can creep into every area of our lives, just like leaven seems to find its way into every nook and cranny of the house. Not quite, perhaps, but we need an exit strategy. Let's remember who has the perfect strategy to lead us to where we, like Job, have come to see we need to be. Let's take our challenges like King Hezekiah and go before God and spread them out before him and ask for his help. And let's listen for the sound of the wind picking up to sweep aside the Red Sea in front of us. We don't have to stay mired in a quagmire of sin. Let's keep reaching out, moving forward toward Pentecost, the day that identifies us as the first fruits of God's plan, reminds us of the power he gives us through the indwelling presence of his Spirit. That next season has some memorable and important lessons of its own, and all we have to do to learn more is wait about 5 weeks.